So we're on class four. The topic is investigating rebirth, so we can have a deep dive into how to start even discussing this. And it's a 10-week course, but you can come along whenever you like. Each topic is a standalone topic, and in particular, this one is probably the only time that we actually get a whole class devoted to this topic. So none of the other courses manage to do it in the way that we do. So what we've already covered in the first few weeks is kind of setting the scene, refuge, what Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are, external Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that lead us to our internal refuge of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, all the benefits of seeing ourselves as being sick, having the disease of afflictive emotions, and that we can heal thyself and also then be able to help others. And then last week in particular about, well, how do we do this? So that's meditation, caring for the mind. And the really simple formula of motivate, meditate, dedicate. So whoever was here last week, was there anything that stood out for you or that you had questions about with this, with the whole meditation thing? On, so oh yeah, that's right. So a lot more than just getting peaceful, but meditate on something. Yes. Yeah, well, that's right, because there's different reasons for meditation. So yeah, great. Good. Well, I hope I also gave you enough to go on of what to meditate on, so it wasn't too overwhelming. But good. Yeah, right. Anybody else? Yeah. Is it Tim? Yeah. Will. I'm second go. I'm getting everybody's second go. It's got an eye in it. I'll get there. Will, yep. Oh, to kind of hitchhike on a task. Yeah. So, what did you do? What did you end up doing?
Well, I've been doing because I'm a chippy, so I have a lot of monotonous tasks of, hammering a nail and put screws in. Just sort of, I've been doing a bit of research on luminous mind and sort of just trying to be luminous mind, I guess. Not really meditate, but just like reminding myself of what that is.
Right. Whilst doing the wonderful repetitive tasks of being a chippy. Yeah. So it's interesting you should mention that because in May we have a international tour of Venerable Gendun, who's coming to lead a few classes and a weekend retreat on luminous mind. Okay, anybody else have anything that stood out or any questions or you finding it difficult? Oh yeah, it's incredibly difficult to not get distracted. But keep in mind that there are like eight stages of meditation. The first stage is just wanting to focus. And then the second stage is being able to focus just for a few seconds. And then it's to kind of keep it in the vicinity so you never lose the object, but you might range way out there and just bring yourself back again. So it takes quite a bit. And like with anything, if anyone's learnt to ride a bike, it takes a while before you stop wobbling or falling right off again and again. That's right. And so if you go, well, this is no good, riding a bike's no fun because you just focusing on falling off. Of course, we're not going to ride a bike, but when you think about where are we riding that bike to and how fun it is to be able to do it, that might help. Okay, so today then, following on is about investigating rebirth. And the main thing about starting our investigation is that it's not to convince you one way or the other. It's just to actually be able to set the scene and ask all of the questions and find where we can get the answers. Because we might have come to a conclusion ourselves, or we may have come to no conclusion and be wondering about it all. And so the main reasons why to investigate rebirth. It's something that we have to investigate at some stage because it is actually the basis of Buddhist philosophy. So not just so Buddhist psychology holds up regardless. You can be a materialist, No problem. Psychology works in the short term. But once we get into thinking about karma, for instance, karma does not stack up if you just look at it over one life because bad things happen to good people. So if we want to understand karma, then we've got to understand, well, who experiences the karma, the person, and what's the nature of the mind and how does it work? So before we can even take karma seriously, we've got to investigate rebirth. And also enlightenment. How is enlightenment going to be possible if we're not thinking about something that happens afterwards? The good thing about this investigation is then once we do start looking at the continuity of mind, huge amounts of things start to make sense. Well, I found they do naturally. So not just karma, but the possibility of liberating ourselves from disturbing emotions, from psychic existence. And then I think we can get a whole lot more benefit from Buddhist psychology rather than just have it as ordinary psychology. And in the short term, we can die without fear or regret. Yeah, that's right. Because, I mean, that's something that's a real niggling, nagging thing, whether we're aware of it or not. It's always there. And as the world gets more distressed, our anxiety levels rise. And why? Because we're not ready to die, basically. And we're just not aware of that until something starts threatening us. So if we start actually kind of looking at it at our nature, and what happened before, what's going to happen next, then we'll actually be able to start changing how we do things and relax and not do anything that we regret. If we think that there's going to be consequences to what we do, we're going to change how we our own life, but also how we treat others. Knowing what's going to happen after we die, can be a great relief. So one of my friends, just before we do our motivation, when they weren't sure, they'd gone and had a test and it was a long weekend, so it was a big long wait before they got the answers back. So they were just the whole time wondering, oh my God, am I going to die? Am I going to die? And they're thinking, well, if I am going to die, then I'm just going to go out and rob a bank. Because they weren't thinking anything further. It's like if all I've got is a few weeks left and there's nothing afterwards, well then, hey, why not? I mean, it's good. It's a weird logic, doesn't it? So it is worth investigating. So let's just set our motivation. So a nice deep breath. Let out any stale air from the lungs. Straighten your spine. Relax your shoulders. Become aware of the stability of your seat and just how our body is sitting here quietly in this room, even though the rest of the world is going on around us. We can bring our mind inwards to just be anchored on the breath, the gentle rhythm of the rising and falling of the breath. And have that as the main focus, everything else just in the periphery. Whatever thoughts or feelings come up, they'll arise, let them fall away. They can just stay on the edges in a nice, relaxed way. So just for a few breaths might help to steady your awareness just by saying breathing in, breathing out. Really enjoy this moment of stillness and space. Then we can set our motivation that whatever we investigate, whatever we contemplate, questions, even confusions, may it all be of a benefit, not just for our own life now, but years into the future. Not just for ourselves, but for everyone we come into contact with. And may that benefit be able to extend outwards like ripples on a pond, so we can become a really positive influence in the world. So a nice deep breath in. Your focus back to the room. And I thought actually to just recommend a few books and then, hey Amanda, some DVDs. So these books here, Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. It's very interesting because it's both worlds. It's coming at it from our Western world, and a whole lot of really fascinating stories of what happens on the operating table when people die but then come back. Then there's a couple there by Vicky McKenzie, Reincarnation, the Boy Lama, and Reborn in the West, the Reincarnation Masters. Both really, really fascinating, particularly Reborn in the West, because people have really different stories. And so there was one story that really impressed me of a New Zealand boy whose parents really did not want him to have anything to do with Buddhism or Dharma, or to accept that he had, any kind of affinity with it. And he got really sick. And so it was just their way of working through it as Westerners. What are the implications of this? Then the DVDs, I'm a great lover of DVDs. So the first one here, The Unmistaken Child, is about our very own Geshe Zopa. So it's his story of looking for the reincarnation of his master. And it's just, I mean, bring your box of tissues. It's really moving, it's really inspiring, because he's looking for the reincarnation and he's assailed with doubts. And he just takes us through the whole journey. And then when he finds the unmistaken child, the incarnation, is really, really moving. And so Geshe Zopa, he's the one that comes every year and teaches us here at Langri Tangpa Centre. Kundun, has anyone seen Kundun, the Scorsese movie? So that's another one, bring your box of tissues. Extraordinarily beautiful movie, but also very accurate about the beginning of the life of His Holiness the Dalai Lama up until his escape from Tibet when the Chinese army invaded. And what's even adds more layers onto it is that many of the actors actually are descendants of who they're playing, their characters. So the descendants of the Dalai Lama's mother, and the granddaughter plays the Dalai Lama's mother, and various things. So it's a really close, extraordinary movie. The Little Buddha, has anyone seen that with Keanu Reeves? Again, really fantastic dual story. There's the modern story, and then the most beautiful depiction of the life of the Buddha that I've come across. And it's so nice that it's the only time I've ever dreamt about the Buddha was when watching that one. And then just recently, and many of these you can see on SBS on demand. This movie called Birth with Nicole Kidman in it, which is it's kind of like a movie. What happens if reincarnation happens in a world in the West where it's not accepted? So in the trailer, it says that her husband dies, and a boy appears who says, I'm the reincarnation of your husband. And of course, everyone freaks out. And it's really well done. Quite disturbing in a way, but I think it's quite realistic of how reincarnation plays out in a culture where it's not accepted. So it gives you a whole range right there of future viewing. So let's have a little dive in then. What is rebirth? So when we're talking about rebirth, it's a continuum and a continuum of mind, continuously taking one body after another. And who decides, who controls? Well, at present, we don't really have very much control over it. Who decides isn't anything external, but we are propelled by karma and attachment, basically. So karma and afflictive emotions, but also karma and our virtuous states of mind. And so that's what propels us. I like to think about it, it's like, can we predict what mood we're going to wake up tomorrow morning? I mean, we've got a general idea, don't we, by what state of mind we go to sleep in. That will kind of predict how we wake up in the morning, but we can't with certainty say we're going to wake up in a fantastic mood or a terrible mood. But it generally has to do with how we've had the previous day. And we can have some control over how we wake up by if we control how we go to sleep. Rebirth is different from reincarnation, and we're kind of a bit loose with the terminology, but I think if we're really trying to get specific, the term that's used in Buddhism is rebirth, taking one body after another. Whereas reincarnation has this connotation of the same person getting born again and again. And that's not what Buddhism's talking about. So, what we're talking about, to put it into perspective, you have a person, and a person is, well, kind of made or imputed upon a body and a mind. I think in the Tibetan language, you have human persons and cat persons and cockroach persons and cow persons. Everyone's a person. I mean, like a living being, a person, imputed on a body and a mind. And or a sentient being, a living being, the ability to know, the ability to think, to feel, to experience, to feel pleasure and pain. And so what we have, a physical continuum of atoms and energy and a mental continuum of experience. So the physical continuum of atoms and energy, well, I just found this nice little picture of, just a weather cycle. So you have water on the ground. It doesn't just disappear, does it? The water goes down, the level goes down in the creek. But it's not like those water atoms are disappearing, are they? We know that they're evaporating, they go up, conditions change and it rains again. With our physical body, it's atomic in nature, meaning it's made of atoms. So when we die, our body just doesn't disappear, does it? Poof. It's still there. And whatever happens, either body's cremated or buried in the ground, and you plant a rose bush on it and turns into really nice roses. You give the roses to somebody, the roses die, like it continues on. It's called the conservation of energy, or the conservation of, the conservation of energy. So it changes form, but it doesn't disappear. It also doesn't come out of nowhere. It's a continuity. So a very simple thing happens, similar thing happens with our mental continuum. And instead of conservation of energy, it's a conservation of consciousness. So it's not that consciousness comes out of nowhere and then disappears. It's moment by moment. There's a continuum that cannot be cut. But it changes. It changes from day to day. It changes from, we think back when we were in our 20s, in our teens, in our toddlers. We're very different. Our mind is very, very different. But there's a continuity there. It hasn't been cut. And even if we're unconscious or asleep, it doesn't stop. We can prove this because has anyone woke up from the alarm clock? Just like a river might disappear, but it just goes underground. So the mind, it can go dormant, but it doesn't break or stop. And I also thought to put in a little bit here that So a person imputed on a body and mind, meaning the form and the mind, the knowing, the experiencing part. So it's quite different from, say, a sunflower, which is living, but it's not a living being. So it reacts, but there's no sentience there. It's alive, it lives, but there's no sentience. So with us, there's sentience. And it's kind of worth getting our head around this because then you look at AI, for instance, and you think, well, it looks like it's sentient. Is it? No, but it's dangerous, isn't it? If we start relating to AI as if it's real and sentient, we're going to get in a lot of trouble. So having a kind of a confusion over this, it's just the confusion that gets us into trouble. It's not the AI or the sunflower that gets us into trouble. So comments, questions, how are we going? Yeah, maybe. So body, mind, and soul, what we come to is we've got to get really good definitions. Yeah. So body and mind, and depends what you're going to think the soul is. It could be the conventional self that's just that is a dependent arising, or it could be subtle mind. So it really depends. So that's we are going to delve into that more and probably next week a lot more. But just to be able to, in your mind, separate out that they are two quite distinct things. Body and mind are quite different in nature. They can have similar kind of function, not functions, but ways of, of being a continuum, for instance. But in nature, they're quite different. One has form, it's atomic. The other has no form. Ah, yes, good question. So that was my very next slide. Well, I can't remember past lives. Good on
I have another one too.
you, Georgie. So why do you reckon? Why do we have difficulty remembering anything? I mean, does anyone have problems remembering things? Always. So why? Why do we have problems? Distractions? Not paying attention, obstacles. Maybe we're preoccupied about some things, so a whole lot doesn't stay in our mind. I think if you talk to little kiddies, some little kiddies will naturally remember past lives. They'll talk about when I was old, for instance, without any prompting, but only when they're really small. So then society comes in. I think because it's so dramatic when you're growing up, big dramatic changes happen and they overlay the previous things. So it's really hard to remember. Like we might remember being in primary school, we might remember being in kindergarten, but if you try and remember back pre-verbally, it's really difficult because we've got no way to describe it. The experiences that we were having when we were 1 or 2 years old, when we didn't have very much language, we've got no way to hook that memory. So we might have impressions of being in a bassinet or something. I have no idea because I'm all words, right? So I just didn't exist before two in my mind. But right there, just because we can't remember back there, I can't remember being two, no way. I can remember being three and tasting champagne for the first time, funnily enough, but being two, I can't remember it. Does that mean I was never two? Oh, tulkus, lamas. So yeah, tulku just means someone who's a recognized reincarnation or rebirth of a previous one. So you have so-and-so tulku, or Lama Zopa was, Lama Zopa Rinpoche was recognized reincarnation or rebirth of the previous Lao Lama. But it doesn't mean that the Lao Lama was born as Rinpoche or that Rinpoche was the Lao Lama. Yeah, and that's why even that DVD was called The Unmistaken Child, because even when you're looking at the continuum of that consciousness, there's lots of possibilities. And so you want to get the unmistaken one. And that's not like it's that one done and dusted. It's to do with what is the one that's going to make the most, have the most benefit in the society. So in the little Buddha, it'll blow your mind because there's more than one reincarnation. But mostly, once we get through childhood, toddlers and childhood, all of those memories get overlaid with other ones. So it's difficult to remember. There's other questions that come up. Where do we get reborn? Where do we get reborn? Any ideas? No, where? Where?
Three realms.
Three realms. What are the three realms? Now, if you're talking about the three realms, it's desire realms, form realm, and formless realms. But within the desire realm, we've got, well, the humans. That's one possibility. But there's other realms, isn't there? There's animals, there's birds and fish and all sorts of things. And in the Buddhist understanding, there's also beings that we can't see, more subtle bodies, but are still within cyclic existence. Ghosts, hellish states, wandering spirits, all sorts of things. So that's not just in the Buddhist understandings, many, many cultures. But the takeaway with this is that it's not that we're just always born human. We go up and we go down, and we go up and we go down, just like we do in life. We go up and we go down. Throughout a day, we go up and down. But I look over eras of my own life, and some have been really good and some have been really terrible. It hasn't just been each decade has been better. In fact, there was a decade there that got really bad. Just look at what happened, what we all went through with COVID. Our life might have had an upwards trajectory and then crashed on down. It took a lot just for our whole society to recover from that. The implications of this is then we've got to, that's why we get this anxiety, what's going to happen to me? Because we don't quite know. There are lots of descriptions of the lower realms in Buddhist psychology, and they may seem outlandish at first, but actually, if you've ever seen a David Attenborough nature documentary about like the tube worms that live on the bottom of the oceans for 300 years next to the volcanic vents at whatever, how many hundreds degrees. I mean, if that's not a hell state, I don't know what is. That's just like on Earth. It's pretty similar to Dante's Inferno. You look at those things. So I can't watch nature documentaries. They're just too traumatic for me. But if it freaks you out too much, you can think at least all of those descriptions of the lower realms, the hells and things, are they're really accurate psychological descriptions of hellish states of mind. Like, when you're in a bad state, that's what describes how it feels. So, at least that. Who decides what rebirth we take? Well, there's not a who, it's a what. It's our own momentum decides. Karma, karmic cause and effect, the natural cause and effect, and everything that's in our mind. So our afflictions and our virtues, we're kind of propelled. And another common question, is it important to remember past lives? What do you reckon? It kind of depends, doesn't it? Because I always find it interesting that people will say, oh, I was Queen Nefertiti in a past life, but they'll never say, I was Queen Nefertiti's chambermaid. There's a Tibetan saying, if you want to know about your past life, look at your present body. If you want to know about your future life, look at your present mind. We received our present rebirth as a result of our past actions. A human rebirth is a fortunate one, and we created the cause for it by living ethically in our previous lives. These good causes were probably created in a fortunate rebirth in the past, because creating such virtue is difficult in unfortunate rebirths. On the other hand, our future rebirth will be determined by what we think, say, and do now, and our mind motivates all these actions. Thus, we can get an idea of the kind of rebirth we'll take by looking at our present attitudes and emotions, and examining whether they are constructive or destructive. We don't need to go to a fortune teller to ask what will become of us. We can simply consider the imprints we are leaving on our mind stream, moment by moment, by our own thoughts, words, and deeds. Was anyone here really naughty in school? Yes? Okay. And so what kept you in line? Did anything ever keep you in line?
Not
at school. No, that's right. So because, you know, or even in uni, it's like people ask you, what do you want to be when you grow up? And it's such a outlandish question, isn't it, when you're a kid? You have all these ideas. And then you're either really good in school or you're really naughty in school, and it's going to have an effect about what happens in the rest of your life. And then you get to the rest of your life and you go, oh, that didn't work out so well. And it's like, it's not because the little kiddie went, I know, I'm going to ruin Miffy's future, or I'm going to ruin John's future, or whatever it is. We just couldn't see that far. And so in the beginning is like, it's fear of mum and dad that might, you know, or fear getting the whipped in the past Queensland education system. When I first came up to Queensland, it was like, and I witnessed people getting whipped at school. I was so shocked. I mean, so I actually stormed up to the headmaster and quoted him all of these educational studies about how whipping kids had a really deleterious effect. Anyway, after he pulled his chin up off the ground from this little grade niner coming up and telling him off. But after that, I think it was outlawed a year later, the whipping. But, so at first it's just those who are close to us in our immediate vicinity that can discipline us. And then afterwards we start trying to plan ahead. But I must admit, even now I find it very difficult to plan ahead. So it's a similar kind of thing. Here we are in this life, we can't even conceive what happens next. And really how we act now, it's just to do with our immediate circumstances. It's quite difficult to stretch our mind and our vision out even further to the future. And so if you're brought up as a cultural Buddhist, you're kind of frightened about the lower realms. Or if you're brought up as a Christian, you're frightened about the hells. And that'll do it when you're a kid, you know. But it doesn't last that long. We need some more to be able to think about it. But the main thing is that, I mean, I dropped out of uni, and just as my friends went up in their career, I just got poorer and poorer. And I'm like, what's happening here? This isn't how it's supposed to be. And it's just because my plan just went to pieces. I couldn't think that far. Anyway, shall we do a little reflection? So settling your posture, a nice balance between a straight spine, a relaxed body. Let your attention settle. Allow your breath to steady. And notice how one inhalation naturally follows the last. And set an altruistic intention to understand our own mind so we can better support others. And notice how each moment of mind is part of a continuous flow. From this continuity arises the awareness that no thought exists in isolation. So as we focus on our breath, various thoughts and feelings just naturally arise. And like a number line, each thought is linked to what came before it. And each thought is linked to what comes after. So, what do you observe when you trace back your most recent thought? You might find it rests on an earlier one, spaced like points on that steady number line. And how do earlier memories shape the thought that you hold now? With observation, the connections appear, arranged like steps along that same line. And what happens when you imagine going even further back to childhood and infancy? Even imagined thoughts form a sequence, aligned along the unbroken line of experience, each moment of experience arising from the previous moment. And what about back to the moment of conception? Does our mind simply come into being out of nothingness? It makes more sense that there was once again a previous moment of mind. This journey along a beginningless timeline leads us to notice the origins of our own thoughts in daily life. And in recognizing that our mind continues unbroken from moment to moment, it truly matters that we guide it gently and deliberately towards what's wise and positive and beneficial. So you can bring your focus back to the room. All right, so now to be able to get to the bottom of this whole rebirth thing, we've got to set our parameters. So in science, in our Western science, we've got a notion of what's a good proof or a working hypothesis. So, I mean, most of us rely or trust in science, don't we? We don't kind of say, oh, Julie, do you believe in gravity? So it kind of sounds weird, doesn't it? Do you believe in physics? Unless you're in America, then perhaps it doesn't sound so weird. But thank goodness we're in Australia and we've got a good education system. So, but why don't we say, oh, I believe in gravity? Why do we just say, well, what do we say? It's proven. So what gives us the confidence about gravity? We're not going to go jump off a cliff. That's because I want to fly and my determination is going to do it. Well, if we were five or six, we might have.
Someone talks.
Someone told us that mum and dad said, don't you? As that's right, as you get older, the whole body succumbs to So we believe in gravity, or we go, yep, I ascribe to gravity. Could anyone describe what the formula is for gravity? No way. So how come we have such confidence in it? Huh?
It's observable.
It's observable evidence. Somebody else has explained the formula, and it's like, yep, that's good enough for me. Our trained researchers, isn't it? It's been, and there's been the whole scientific proof accepted by peers, tested out. So even though we've got a scientific theory, none of us knows what the formula is. It's not that we believe in it. We've got this unshakable kind of experience of gravity. And when you see a balloon and the little kitty lets go of the string and the balloon goes up, what happens? Do we go, oh no, gravity's wrong? No, we don't, do we? So there's something there. We've got this understanding, and it's a really deep kind of thing, because we don't have an existential crisis when we see the balloon go up. So what makes a good proof scientifically? It's got three things. It's repeatable, it's consistent, and it's predictive. And this is really nice because we can test our own theories with this. So in the repeatable, in the same situations, the same conditions, the result is the same. It can be replicated. It's consistent. So like, for instance, so repeatable, you put the pot on the stove and it heats the water. And you can go home and put the pot on the stove and have confidence it is also going to heat the water. It's consistent, it happens in every case. So we don't have to worry, oh no, perhaps you go home and put the pot on the stove and it's not going to heat the water. You don't have to worry about
Might take longer to
it. Depending what's going to heat it, that's right, the conditions may vary. But it's consistent. So things like the whole flat Earth theory, it's not like every year we have to reprove the Earth is round, not flat. It's like once it's proved, that's it. Just once, it's done and dusted. And predictive. This is a really fun thing. So it means that it re explains a whole lot of other unrelated phenomena. I can make soup. I can heat a bath. I can do a whole lot of things. Once we understand heat, the whole universe opens up to us. So the same thing, I think, with when we're looking at rebirth, that once we get our head around it, a whole lot of other things open up. And the Buddhist path becomes really powerful and strong. So this is, again, I've been reading from this book, Buddhism for Beginners by Thupten So it's all question and answer. So the question, what's the relationship between Buddhism and science? They have many points in common. For example, both depend on logic and investigation to ascertain the nature of phenomena. Both discourage blind faith and encourage free inquiry on the part of the student. Buddhism does not contradict current scientific theories about the origin of this universe or the physical evolution of human species. In fact, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said that if scientific findings contradict what's written in Buddhist scriptures, then Buddhists must accept that new information. However, if science cannot actively disprove what's stated in the scriptures, there's no need to abandon those concepts. So, for example, although scientists have not yet proven the existence of rebirth, they've not been able to disprove it. Both science and Buddhism use the theory of cause and effect to explain how things function. Science investigates cause and effect as it functions in the physical material world, whereas Buddhism explores it in terms of the mind. So it takes a lot of courage, though. Science hasn't disproven rebirth yet. And we can ourselves, I think, deduce. We can use reasoning and logic and put it together, even if it's not obvious. If we have the courage to investigate and be consistent, the implications are really profound. There's a lot of implications. It's going to radically change the way we live our life. You're not going to go out and rob the which I'm pleased to say my friend did not do, but it was a close one. So this is from Gelug Rinpoche, Good Life, Good Death. So he also brought up in Old Tibet, but living in the West, I think in New York possibly. My understanding of reincarnation came gradually through a long process of learning from the great Buddhist teachers, Buddhist texts, and learning through debate, meditation, and practice. And after all of that, I can now say I have some kind of firm and unshakable belief in reincarnation or rebirth. It comes from a deeper consciousness that lies at the heart level, a kind of pervasive understanding. And I've got to say, I think I have a pervasive understanding coming from a scientific point of view. That's when I go, oh, yeah, it must be right. Okay, not a voice, but a comprehension coming from inside rather than outside. That's why I believe in reincarnation, not only because Buddha said one should. Some friends tell me that this is just Tibetan conditioning, but the same could be said for the Western lack of belief in reincarnation. Cultural thing. In Tibet, we saw or heard of small children resuming conversations with adults right where they'd been left off in previous lifetimes, performing religious rituals they couldn't possibly know, or insisting they lived in houses in distant cities they'd never been to with people they'd never met in their current lives. If I didn't believe in reincarnation, of course, all this would present obvious contradictions. So, I'm not here to try and convince you about reincarnation. That's my culture, my system, not yours. I'd simply like to ask you to entertain the idea for a moment, to give it the benefit of the doubt and see it, how it changes your perspective of life and of your life and your death. You may not get a complete confirmation that there is reincarnation, but you won't be able to rule it out either. No one has been able to prove that it does not take place. If you give reincarnation the benefit of the doubt, the question of who we are and where we come from becomes what happened between our previous life and this one, or during our previous lives. The moment we think like that, our perspective changes. So it's worth having some good, healthy doubts. So what are some doubts that have come up? Anything? I see you've frowning there, John. Tell me. You're just putting it together. What are you?
I'm a skeptic.
Good, excellent. This is a good start. Skeptic is a good start.
I gave away organized religion because I thought it was all a fool. I'm really a believer. But right at this point in time, I'm a bit skeptical.
Yeah,
It's
that's
really
right.
interesting. I think it's
So
about.
it's Probably it's good not to go, oh, I believe it. It's actually much better to come to it as a natural progression. So it's not something that you just take on and ascribe to, but just like how in our when we learn science at school, we gradually learned about stuff.
Well,
And
I'm not knocking it. I think it's
yeah, no,
great.
you can knock it all you like because
But I just.
that's the good thing about investigation, that the more you probe into it, the clearer things should become. And to not be frightened of that, it's good. It's good to start off being skeptical about it all because we've got to come to it in our own way, not in a culturally Buddhist way, in our culture's kind of way. And so it's got to have this scientific backing to it, and at least to use the scientific investigation. Yeah, how we come at proofs, we can have working hypotheses, we can prove things, we can disprove things, it's all on different levels, but what we've got to do is be consistent. That's the thing. And actually in this book, Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron, The Foundation of Buddhist Practice, there's some really great stuff in here of just nutting through the Western points of view. So
Adrian's got a
Oh,
question.
He's not sure whether you're going to discuss this or not, but is it fair to say that what does pass on from life to life is the storehouse consciousness informed by karma?
I'm not sure what the storehouse consciousness is. I think that's in a different tenet school from what we're studying here, which is Lama Tsongkhapa's middle way. So when we're going to kind of take it bit by bit. Next week, we're going to look at the mind, and then after that, we're going to look at karma. So you've got to stay tuned for the next two episodes. So there are some questions that we have. So the first one that comes up is, well, we can't remember. And that's kind of like a just a, an emotional kind of response that we have that I think once we start actually investigating the nature of memory and how poor my memory is, just because we can't remember doesn't mean that it didn't happen. What do they say about Woodstock? Yeah, memory, it's a tricky thing. And also how we remember things can change over time, depending on how much we're blocking out, how much denial we're in, how much we grow as a human person, how we remember our parents when we're a teenager, for instance, or then when we remember our parents when you first become a parent yourself, how you think of them in your memory completely changes. No, you're going to remember the impression of it. And if we can't remember our first birthday party where all the adults came together and blew out the candles for us while we were probably sleeping in the other room, doesn't mean it didn't happen. We might say, oh, well, because there's no proof, but this is a really interesting one because to it's if you're in a culture where rebirth is just understood, there's heaps of proof. And so you just find like an example that makes sense to you, like that the kitty that was saying the other thing that he would say, someone would sneeze and he'd say Gesundheit, and he'd say a couple of other German words, and there was no one around that was German. There was just no way. How did he have those? And then his mum asked him, oh, so asked some question about, do you believe in reincarnation? And he said, no, don't be stupid. But anyway, when I was old, blah, 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 blah. So he didn't have a conception of it, but it was just came out naturally. The thing about this is that we just need one person to remember. And then that's it. It's not like we have to reprove it every year. And now there are better stories and kind of evidence that's not a, it's not in the kind of I was Queen Nefertiti style. It's actually much more legitimate. We've got a lot more access now. I think the biggest one is that our culture doesn't accept rebirth, and it's really difficult to be in a, to kind of get our head around it that way. All right, so our culture, the way that our culture understands things too changes over time. Because if we had have been born like before the Renaissance, we would have still been ascribed to the flat Earth theory. Absolutely. And there was a time, remember, when all of the study about the planets and the sun was that the sun revolved around the Earth. And what was really weird was that it kind of it was a predictive theory. It was just a really clunky one. So then the theory changed. So how we even we've got to be even flexible with our scientific theories and look at it in a nuanced way. Received wisdom, that's why I really think it's great to encourage questioning, to really kind of hone that questioning rather than just think, oh, I have to accept it. So good on you. Now, there's a few other ones. So, one, two, three. I came from a creator, I came from nothing, or I came from my parents. So, this is what His Holiness and Thupten Jodrum was saying about this. If our mind comes from our parents' minds, or if our mind were a collection of different parts of the minds of people who died before our birth, many logical inconsistencies would arise. Because each individual has his or her own mind stream. We can remember events from our past and we'll experience the results of our own actions, not those of other people. These would be impossible if our mind was composed of fragments of our parents' or other people's minds. If we said instead that consciousness emerged from matter after a period of time, then did consciousness appear in all material particles? If not, what would make consciousness emerge from some particles but not others? Along this line, if scientists could construct a brain, would that brain be conscious? Would it be a person who experiences happiness and suffering? So all of these things of how what we come from. So coming from a creator, well, this one, of course, doesn't stack up in the Buddhist terminology, and I think there's a whole lot of people that come here that might have gone to say Sunday school and be got in trouble for being naughty by saying, well, if God created us, who created God? That was you. And then you got whipped for it.
I got in trouble at Sunday school and school.
Sunday school and school. Excellent. Very good. So just keep being consistent about it, because actually it's a logical inconsistency that if we need a creator, then necessarily the creator needs a creator. And it's a question that naturally comes up. Then we can have the kind of the nihilistic theory, oh, I come from nothing. But then we can even start thinking, well, is there anything that comes from nothing in our world? No, there's a conservation of energy, isn't there? So it doesn't really make sense. So this is what we're getting at. What makes more sense? So, with our mind, does it come from nothing? Does that make more sense than coming from a previous moment of mind, conservation of consciousness? The other thing about this of thinking, oh, I came from nothing, is that we can think, well, just because we can't identify where we come from doesn't mean there is no cause. We just haven't identified the cause yet. So if we don't know where our mind comes from, we haven't identified it yet, we haven't found it yet, doesn't mean there is no cause. Why was I born me? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, because the mind stream then, it's not that we're born like a blank slate, are we? There's something that comes along that's there and it's quite unique. Yeah, I often think, why wasn't I, say, born an Israeli, or why wasn't I born a Palestinian?
Yeah.
And would I have been different? Yeah. So they're good questions to pose and then take very slowly. The one about thinking that I come from my parents, well, our DNA comes from our parents, and that's a really nice thing to think, because then, I mean, Geshe's Oprah even goes so far to say that this is like, it's not even our body. It's actually the DNA of our parents. Thank you so much. We're in this, like, this borrowed receptacle that we can do all of this stuff and have this amazing life. It's not even ours. But our mind, if it came from our parents, we would be half our mother and half our father. And we may be neither of them. And what if our father was patient and our mother was short-tempered? Then we can't be both of those. Also, there's all those things of like child prodigies, isn't there? Where you have a musical prodigy in a family, no one else in the family is musicals. Like, where did they get it from? Ask that same kind of question. Then there's the it's not really pop science, popular science, but there's just a kind of received cultural thing in our society of assuming body and mind are the same, and it's just an assumption. And when you what it doesn't stand up to anything, because by nature they're completely different, and there's a lot of confusion that comes from this. So when we from a scientific point of view, because science is about exploring the physical world, when science tries to explore things that are not physical, it gets very, very tricky, like memory, for instance. And if you read any scientist that's exploring memory, they all say the more we study, the less we know. And that's pretty much across the board, because they're different kinds of things. So, and we can have our body can be in pain, but our mind can be fine, isn't it? That's how people learn to live with chronic pain. It's either going to drive you insane, or you find a way to keep the mind happy while Your body's in pain. On the other side, we can say body and mind, they're not the same, because we can be physically fine, healthy, and miserable. They affect each other, but they're not the same. The other one that comes a lot, mind comes from body. Well, that's definitely in our pop culture. And many times in articles and things, you'll hear people say, oh, as we all know, as the mind comes from the brain, blah, 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 as if the mind is an emergent property of the brain, which again does not stand up under investigation. A non-physical thing coming from a physical thing. But even if we say that body and mind are the same, then and mind comes from body, so then when we die, then the mind stops. Then why are we frightened of death? Why do we have an anxiety about dying? Because if our mind stopped, then there's no problem. But yet we do, and it's not even a choice. We have this fear or anxiety about death, whether we want to or not. So naturally, we're thinking about what comes afterwards. We can get a lot of ideas from how our culture looks at these things by the kind of sci-fi and horror movies that are out because they ask all of these questions and I think pose them in a really good way. So there's countless sci-fi movies about being able to extract memories from people's brains and implant them in somebody else's. And I mean, that's why they're so fascinating, because they pose this question and then you either believe the science or you look at it and you go, yeah, but that can't be true because da, da, da. But it's a fantastic way to investigate it. So far, no one's been able to take a memory out from a brain and put it in someone else's brain. It's not possible. And even trying to find where a memory, which is a non-physical thing, is in a physical thing, it's not possible. The whole Frankenstein hypothesis, by the way, Frankenstein, the Bride, the latest one that's out, it's fantastic, as an aside. But again, something mental can come from something physical like that. Where the cutting edge here with this, where I think if you're into the science side of things, your reading can go is everything about neuroplasticity. Because that shows that it's a two-way street. It's not causality. And that's really radical. And that's why it's still not globally accepted in our Western science, because the flow-on implications shape the whole basis of scientific thought about the mind. So what we can end up with, the healthy one, is to just go, well, I just don't know. Still working on it. I'm still thinking about it. And that's a good place to start. It's better to have that thought than go, no, I want to believe in it, or no, I can't possibly because I don't want to contemplate what happens to me next. It's better to just stay in this uncertainty and gradually come to it as a conclusion rather than a belief. And that's why I put in this stuff about a good proof, that when we start thinking about it, to really try and think about it using reasoning and logic rather than just going with what we like the idea of or what we don't like the idea of. So this is the photo of Punsog Rinpoche, who is the unmistaken child, so the recognized rebirth of Geshe Lama Khonsog. And so Punsog Rinpoche actually came to Langri Thompson Center and gave a talk when he was about this age, 12. He's in his 20s now. It was quite an extraordinary event. The recognized reincarnation of the great Mahasiddha Geshe Lama Khonsog, who I also met as a child. He taught up at Chenrezig Institute. So the Tibetans have this whole system of being able to look for and find the the rebirth of these great masters that determined to come back. So they're not propelled by karma and affliction. They're propelled by karma, cause and effect, and compassion to come back on purpose, like really deep altruistic momentum to come back and help sentient beings. Anyway, let's do a little reflection on this. And Adrian online, this might go sometime towards answering the question that you answered a while back about tulkus. Okay, so let's just settle our posture again. Let your awareness become open to the simple truth that we are not blank slates. We arrive already shaped by past tendencies, memories, imprints. Just as each day is shaped by our past tendencies and imprints. Feel your breath steady and continuous, reminding you that our consciousness can be steady, continuous, and reshaped just like a stream changes course. Can widen into a river, yet retains its continuity. And with our own minds, just like a bodhisattva, we can guide our consciousness through intention, through observing karma, through cultivating compassion, and when we do this, our future experiences become less random and more aligned with emerging wisdom. So consider reincarnation as a rare chance to pick up where you left off, much like a child prodigy who effortlessly remembers how to conduct an orchestra or compose a sonata. So what patterns in your life feel as if they've carried over, already guiding you? Notice any skill or passion that came effortlessly. And how do you respond to responsibilities that feel much larger than you? Observe whether they reflect capacities you already possess. And what intention do you want your next moment of rebirth to follow? Choose one rooted in compassion and an understanding of karmic cause and effect. So while liberation ends the uncontrolled cycle of rebirth, long before that, we can still influence our future by observing karma, making aspirational prayers, and nurturing a sincere wish to help others. So let this reflection inspire one small, meaningful action that adds more benefit to the world than was there yesterday. Okay. So to sum up a little bit from His Holiness. So even if you cannot ascertain the existence of future lives, you can tentatively accept it without any harm. Wishing to create the causes for fortunate future lives, you will endeavor to subdue your afflictions and cultivate your good qualities. And this in turn will help you to be happier in the present because you'll experience things freshly without the confusion of attachment and anger. If you find it difficult to accept past and future lives, set the topic aside and focus on being a good person in this life. Do not create trouble for others and use your life to bring calm and peace in your own mind and in the world. This is more important. If at the time of death you find that there is no future life, nothing has been lost. But if you find that there is, at least you've prepared for it by living a good life now. This is better than someone who accepts future lives but does not behave properly in his daily life, and thus makes problems for himself and others. So that kind of leads us to what's commonly known as Pascal's wager, which, with His Holiness's immaculate logic, we can approach as well. So we've got one side belief in rebirth and the other no belief in rebirth. So, okay. Over on this side, we believe in rebirth and it turns out to not be true. Well, that's okay. Because you've led a good life anyway. You believe in rebirth, you've prepared for the future, you've tried to tame your own mind to help others, all of these things. That's going to just make your own life better now. If there's no rebirth, no loss, just like His Holiness said. It's okay. Of course, if you prepare for rebirth and there is rebirth for you, okay, that's a close one. Lucky. Infinite gain. The one, if it turns out to not be true, okay, it's finite gain. On the other hand, if we go, nope, I don't believe in rebirth, and that's true, there is no rebirth, it's like, oh, well. Didn't believe in rebirth, went out and robbed a bank. Which is pretty much like if I think about it and there is no future consequence, why the heck am I bothering being a good person? I can't be bothered with that. Like, I don't have the patience for that. Bugger them all. Let's just go out and do, like, pretty much that's why we have such a contentious, materialistic society, because actually it's a logical response to no belief in the future. Because this whole thing, because you want to be a good person, well, that never did it for me. I don't want to be a good person. I need to be convinced. Actually, if there's no future lives, then hedonism is the logical response. And not just nice hedonism, but the robbing the bank type, like if we're going to look at it logically. Not condoning any of it, don't get me wrong. But if you don't believe in rebirth, and this is the one over there in red, and it turns out to be true, and you've gone and robbed that bank and you've raised hell your whole life because you've thought, this is it. I'm just going to, it's like the Wolf of Wall Street. I'm just going to take everything that there is. You can have a lust for life. And then you wake up in your next life with the results of that, with constant craving and dissatisfaction. You're in real trouble. That's right. It applies to that's Pascal's wager, indeed. Any religious belief. Yes. So then what we do is we have this really nice middle waves, which is we provisionally believe. It's really nice because we're not kind of abdicating all of our reasoning, logic, or questioning and giving up. We're staying in that uncertainty and provisionally believing. Because it makes the most sense, and continuing to investigate. But there's a tension there, isn't there? If we provisionally believe we're going to be being better people, kinder, both through our own self-interest but also caring for others. Because, of course, when we think about rebirth in terms of others, then everybody that I dislike now or who's being horrible now or being really destructive now hasn't always been like that. In the past, they've been kind. In the past, I've probably been indebted to them. They probably helped me. So we're looking at this really big cycle. It's like, how can you really truly hate anybody? You can really hate what they're doing right now, but if we've all been connected and had all these relationships in the past, you know, they could have been my best friend. How could I hate them? So it makes this whole thing of caring for others without bias, like the four immeasurables of having equanimity and caring for others, it gives it a really solid foundation, not a foundation on emotion, which is really up and down. Because you can care for someone until they do the wrong thing, and then it's like, that's it. No more. I'm cutting them out of my life. And it's really biased. But if you go, that's it, I'm not having anything to do with them in my life anymore, but you keep them close in your heart because there's that connection there. They're part of the cycle. You know, at one time they were so close to me. How could I hate them? In fact, at some time they were so close to me and now they're just screwing up so badly, it makes you care for them more rather than hate. So this is the whole thing, that if we start having an understanding of rebirth, even provisionally, that how it affects everything else is really powerful. Yeah, wisdom and method. Yep. Yeah, well, if they're harming you, it's like with our cats, you know, we've got to give them a pill and then they bite you. It's not like, you're no cat of mine. Yeah. You just feel even more sorry for them.
Yeah.
And you know they can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just making things worse for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But you still genuinely care and there's a closeness there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, provisionally believe, just in case, see how you go, and then slowly, slowly. And it is literally a life or death question, right? So we want to be safe. So we've got, in summary, when we're talking about rebirth, it's the basis of Buddhist philosophy, of the science of Buddhism. It's the basis of it. Without it, karma and enlightenment don't make any sense. Without it, what you have is Buddhist psychology. You have a nice ethical system and an understanding of our emotions, but that's as far as it goes. So you really miss out on the main point of Buddhism, which is liberation from cyclic existence completely. You still get a good bit, but you know, you miss out on the main bit. As we're investigating, be scientific, adopt a good proof, be really consistent. And this is where I find all of the scientific kind of pop science books and articles and stuff that I read really embarrassing, because the scientists aren't consistent. They will. You'll get halfway through the book, and it's all fantastic about neuroscience and causality and all sorts of things. And then they'll fall off the wagon, and they'll interchange brain and mind.
Yeah.
And I go, how can you be a scientist and conflate those two things in some paragraphs of your book and not in other paragraphs of your book and not even notice? And I get so incensed, I throw the book out the window, and then, you know, Eddie has to go and get it back out from the garden. But it's embarrassing. How can you be a scientist and not be consistent either? And provisionally, if we provisionally believe, at least we can die without fear or regret. And we would have had a good, peaceful life, regardless of what's going on around us. So just keep on the questioning. During the week, the contemplations, well, recognize what you brought to this life already. So that's the things that we're good at and we love doing. Where does that come from? And the things that we hate doing that we're no good at, it's probably because we don't haven't brought any of that through. And then thinking in the future, what are we going to do with our inheritance? We've inherited from our past. What we have now, what are we going to do? How are we going to use our inheritance? Are we going to be like a Paris Hilton and not use our inheritance? Are we going to be Nepo babies? Or are we going to actually use this inheritance that we have from the past? Well, that effort. So next week, then, we're diving in a bit deeper. We've been talking about rebirth. Well, what is reborn? This is what you were, yeah. And a little bit more about the difference between brain and mind and what our potential is. So any last questions or comments before we finish? Are you clearer or more confused? Aha, that's in death and rebirth class. Yeah, we will actually go into that. But yeah, I mean, that's another of those things that comes up. How come we have an immediate affinity with someone? We just click. Where does that come from? It's a result. What's the cause of it? And how come we have an immediate dislike of somebody and not everybody else does? You know, if everybody else had the immediate dislike, but no, it's never consistent like that. So those connections, that again, it's not the blank slate. We come already. And anyone who's had a child will know that a child comes with their own stuff. As much as you like to take their stuff off them, they've got their own stuff. And it's surprising and something you'd never even think of what that stuff is. So it's more just, you know, bit by bit putting it together, what makes more sense, what's workable, testing it on your own experience. Can we use this for other things? Yeah. And those questions, regardless of how outlandish they are, just start writing them down because once you capture the question, Siri has become sentient.
Skynet.
Skynet has upon us. That's really funny. Yeah, well, that's again, that's why we've got to start investigating mind and body and what happens at death. Because, yeah. And the other thing, too, within Buddhism that's been a lot more overt and clearer is what things to take literally and what to take figuratively. And there's whole guidelines of how to tell. And in fact, a lot of the, especially when you come to tantric practices, they're like six different layers that you take from it being literal or figurative metaphors, and then different layers of metaphors on a conventional level, a mid-level, a most subtle level. So, and how to tell when someone says, oh, it's like this, what level to take it. And this is then when I've read, you know, about how to interpret the Bible. There's no guide there to say, was this literal or is this metaphorical?
Yeah, there's no one commentary.
There's no commentary like that. I think in the Jewish tradition, you've got much more commentary. In the Christian tradition, it was a different kind of approach. So yeah, again, we've got to have a good way to investigate this. Because personally, I think of course it can happen, but not necessarily in the way that's described. Just like a balloon can go up, it goes up, but it doesn't discount the laws of gravity. There's just more to it. So you have these stories and legends that also have great emotional effect on people. And so we've got to look at, well, what's actually happening? Well, I have to look at what's happening. I want to know. I don't just want to believe. It's not enough to believe. But at the same time, I'm not going to discount it just because it sounds outlandish and difficult, just like the balloon going up. Okay, more confused, understand a bit more, also helpful. So this is good. What we want is doubt tending to the truth. Okay, fantastic. Let's dedicate. So letting everything settle into your mind, imagine everything we've discussed is like seeds of light or drops of light alighting in your mind, illuminating your mind, that we can come back to whenever we want, in whichever manner that we like to contemplate and reflect on, that we can become more familiar with the luminous nature of our mind, that we can use this information and investigation to make our own lives better now, better for others as well, and to take it on board so that into the future, however far it extends, we can be assured we bring ultimate benefit to ourselves and all living beings. So, thank you very much, everyone.